It can be hard balancing taking care of kids, senior loved ones, and yourself. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Find background-checked sitters, nannies, and senior caregivers who can help with everything from watching kids after school to senior meal prep. Whether you need full-time, part-time, or even occasional help, you can view rates and book highly rated caregivers that fit your budget and schedule. Get the help you need with Care.com.
This season, Instacart has your back to school. As in, they've got your back to school lunch favorites like snack packs and fresh fruit. And they've got your back to school supplies like backpacks, binders, and pencils. And they've got your back when your kid casually tells you they have a huge school project due tomorrow. Let's face it, we were all that kid. So first, call your parents to say I'm sorry, and then download the Instacart app to get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes all school year long. Get a $0 delivery fee with your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 an order. Additional terms apply.
The New Statesman.
Hello, I'm Hannah Barnes, Associate Editor at The New Statesman, and you're listening to The New Statesman podcast. For the last 8 weeks, we've been publishing daily episodes covering the UK's general election, and we're going to continue to publish every day this week. But our focus, along with the rest of the world, has turned at least temporarily to the United States. Just over 48 hours after narrowly escaping death from a gunman's bullet, Donald Trump has been confirmed, unsurprisingly, as the Republican Party's candidate for president in the upcoming election. He's also named critic turned loyalist J.D. Vance as his running mate. Now, I'm joined in the studio, as it's a Tuesday, by our political editor, Andrew Marr. Welcome.
Thank you, Hannah.
Later in the podcast, we're going to turn back to the UK and look at that string of resignations we've seen today from the Welsh government and look ahead to tomorrow's King's Speech. But let's kick off with Trump and the United States. J.D. Vance, quite an extraordinary speech overnight about, well, Britain, really.
Yes, we're still trying to work out how to think about J.D. Vance. A lot of people here know him from his extraordinary memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, about growing up white and poor in a kind of drug-ravaged community in the Appalachians. And he has been seen right across the board by writers and politicians of the left as well as the right as an exceptional talent when it comes to that. But bit by bit, he has been moving towards Trump. He started as an anti-Trumpian, described Trump famously as America's Hitler, and yet, despite that, has been able to kiss the ring and grovel enough to get this extraordinary tip as vice presidential candidate.
The ultimate shapeshifter.
The ultimate shapeshifter. You know, more traditional anti-MAGA Republicans like Mitt Romney absolutely loathe Vance. And he certainly seems quite loose with what he said.
What is the first truly Islamist country that will get a nuclear weapon? And we were like, maybe it's Iran, you know, maybe Pakistan already kind of counts. And then we sort of finally decided maybe it's actually the UK since Labour just took over.
It's difficult to work out how he's come to that conclusion. But parking that, how on earth does this Labour government respond to that kind of rhetoric? And were Trump to win in November, which is looking increasingly likely, how are they going to deal with a Trump presidency?
Well, they're going to have to start to dial down their own rhetoric first if they want an agreement, an arrangement with the Trump administration. Actually, the new Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, who has been frequently to Washington trying to build bridges with the Republicans around Trump, has been speaking to, I think, J.D. Vance himself. So there is some kind of connection there. How effective or creaky it will be, we don't yet know. But, you know, David Lammy has been tweeting quite aggressively about Trump recently as well. And I think on both sides, we have to be very careful about the language we use. Because one thing we know about Trump, this is a man who never forgets.
Were you surprised at all by the choice of running mate? I mean, some people had wanted Trump to pick Nikki Haley, who obviously ran against him and failed, but to try and broaden the appeal of the Republican ticket. Are you surprised that he's gone for someone who shares all of his views, well, for the time being at least, and is even more extreme?
No, I'm not, because I think this is one of the outcomes of the failed assassination attempt we can talk more about later. I think this emboldens him. You can see in the polls he's already creating even more space between him and Joe Biden. I think he feels very confident and therefore not in a position where he has to, as it were, widen his appeal further. He doesn't need that. And we know that he wants to come in and do a second presidency much more aggressively than the first presidency, get rid of all those people who are the guardrails, the human guardrails around him, urging caution or think again or think thrice or whatever it might be. He wants people who are with him. He wants to sack the senior diplomats and senior members of civil service in Washington and replace them with MAGA Republicans in his image. So it's not at all surprising that he wants a vice president in his image as well.
I mean, certainly those attending in Milwaukee will be Trump supporters anyway, but the response he received following the assassination attempt, it was almost messianic, wasn't it?
We are here tonight with one purpose, and that is elect Donald J. Trump as the next president of the United States. He is here tonight to show his courage, his defiance against somebody who tried to kill him.
Very close to messianic. There's lots of images of Christ lifting him away from the shooting. And there are even reports of people collecting tiny little samples of his blood and selling it as a healing balm in a kind of here's Christ's blood kind of way. The level of adulation now of Trump is extraordinary. And I think he has realized that this has taken him to a new place. Quite how he's going to respond, we don't know until we actually hear his speech. And there were indications initially that this might produce a more healing, more kind of consensual Donald Trump. Strange idea, though that might be, to the extent that he was talking about Americans standing together against evil. And Melania Trump was saying, we have to start to think about the days when we go beyond left and right, when we go beyond blue and red, which from anyone in the Trump family is quite something. But I think the appointment of Vance squashes any thought that there is somehow a more consensual, gentler Donald Trump in the wings.
This week's magazine, understandably, we're having a Trump special. And you've written a feature about assassination and whether or not these ever work. But you start in really quite a dark place.
Well, I'm sorry, but it's a thought that I think has been thunk by liberals all around the world, which is what if the bullet had just gone very slightly to the left, or if Trump hadn't turned his head at that time? The prospect
I
of a second
had that thought, I have to
a
say.
Prospect. Well, I think a lot of people have a prospect of a second Trump presidency, which is an existential threat to NATO, to Western security, and certainly to Ukraine, would have gone. I mentioned that because I think that is the essential context to make the argument against assassination, to argue that assassination almost never works, almost never produces the results that the assassin expects, and in many ways produces perverse and dangerous results. In this case, it'll be the massive victory, I suspect, of Donald Trump in the November election.
I mean, what would have happened had it been successful? I mean, we can only guess, I suppose.
I think the fundamental error that the sort of assassination idea makes is to conflate a single human individual with tyranny or oppression or some big political problem. All of those things are created by massive social and economic forces. They are the surrounding architecture in which tyranny or authoritarianism or simple bullying can take place. I think successful, economically prosperous, well-protected, healthy democracies do not throw up tyrants. Societies in deep crisis, as America is, as most European societies in different cases are as well, do produce tyrants. And simply think, I'll take that tyrant off the chessboard, does not actually change the game very much.
But you're very careful not to compare Donald Trump, who has been democratically elected in the past, he's been chosen by his party now, to the likes of, you know, the most heinous individuals in history, the likes of obviously Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin. I mean, he's not, is he? He's not that.
No, he's not. But I think the comparison is only interesting when you make the case against assassination. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the most cliched argument for assassination would be you're sitting in the Osteria Bavaria in Munich in the early to mid 1930s, and the little man with the moustache comes in for his plate of trout, and you have a revolver. Do you do it? or not? And I think most people would say, if I had the courage, I hope I would. But of course, if you took Hitler out of the 1930s Germany at that point, you don't get rid of anti-Semitism, which is deeply rooted in that society. You don't get rid of the profound middle-class paranoia caused by hyperinflation and the extremism. You don't get rid of the Nazi Party, which is already created a form of authoritarianism that is very hard to fight back against. All of those things are still there. So you might get another leader to replace the martyr Hitler, but another leader who perhaps, I suggest, might not have made the egregious errors that Hitler himself did, might not have turned against the Soviet Union until Britain had been finally defeated to the West, or might not have turned against the Soviet Union at all, and therefore, rather like Robert Harris's novel Fatherland, might well have still been in power by the 1960s. So you just don't know.
No, we don't know. I mean, it's extraordinary because, I mean, intuitively, as someone who lost extended family in the Holocaust, I'd think, yeah, you take out Hitler and then perhaps it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, and that is exactly why I took the most obvious and egregious example. But of course, there are many more. Gavrilo Princip, who killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand, famously in Sarajevo, in 1914. What he wanted was a South Serbian republic or monarchy outside the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He didn't want the First World War. And even the famous assassination or killing of Kirov, Stalin's great rival and friend, in St. Petersburg in 1934, or Petrograd, Leningrad, I should say, in 1934, was the trigger for Stalin's Moscow trials and the Great Terror. So if that assassination was meant to be a protest against the authoritarian and brutal tendencies of Bolshevik Russia at that time, it made things worse, not better. And I just use these examples because again and again
and
again,
well, you never know what the consequences
are going to be. Consequence. And the same applies, by the way, I think, to American democracy. Mm. When you look at the effect of the assassination of Martin Luther King, or of Lincoln, or of Kennedy, and so on.
What do you make of the Republican line of attack that the assassination attempt was in part, at least, because of the rhetoric used by the Democrats and referring to Donald Trump in negative terms, that they've somehow incited this act of violence?
I think they have a point. I think Donald J. Trump Jr., Trump's son, when he said this was caused in part by people on the Democrat side who say of my father, he is literally the same as Hitler. If you think that Trump is literally the same as Hitler and you're a young guy with a gun, that makes it much more plausible that you'd try and take a pop at him. I mean, those of us on this side of the Atlantic would point out that this is a country with more guns than people and a long history of political violence that goes all the way back to the beginning of the Republic. It's not a normal democratic society. And that is also part of the story.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know much about the shooter, but it seems at least that he wasn't a Democrat supporter. So we don't really know. But I mean, it just seems ludicrous to... You're right to compare Trump to Hitler.
I think where they have a point is that language really matters. That old thing about sticks and stones will break my bones, but words won't ever hurt me is wrong. Words become sticks and stones if they're sharp enough and they inflame passions enough. They can turn into sticks and stones or bullets. Mm. And therefore, I think we all have to be very careful, including in our political culture, about the words and the language we choose for people we disagree with. It is not true that Labour MPs have the blood of slaughtered Palestinian children on their hands. And, you know, we should call that kind of thing out.
Absolutely. And no violence against anyone should be condoned. After the break, we're going to talk about the implosion at the top of Welsh Labour and the upcoming King's Speech. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all of our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Hello, I'm Richard Williams, Architectural Development Manager for VELUX. VELUX is proud to have partnered with the Housing Design Awards since 2020. Established in 1948 by Parliament, at the same time as the NHS, these government-backed awards highlight the link between good housing and good health. Today, the awards celebrate first-class housing design that focus on elements like daylight, fresh air and indoor comfort, the same things that inspired our founder to establish VELUX back in 1941 and become the world's leading roof window manufacturer. To learn more, visit velux.co.uk/housing-design-awards.
Before we turn to tomorrow's King's Speech, which will set out the UK government's legislative plans for the next parliament. I want to go briefly to the Labour Welsh Government in Wales, which appears to be in turmoil at the point at which we're recording. Four resignations from the cabinet, clearly coordinated, all done on social media. They're calling for Vaughan Gething to go. Echoes for me of the mass sort of coup against Boris Johnson.
I was going to say that. I'm glad you had that echo too. Yes, this takes us back to those extraordinary days when, you know, so much of the cabinet and the government just walked out on Boris Johnson within a matter of hours. Well, this is a Welsh Labour version of the same thing, because actually, in terms of the size of the Welsh cabinet, it's pretty much a third of the cabinet has gone just like that, including Vaughan Gething's biggest critic. And this all goes back to a kind of a financial row or scandal that has dogged him for a long time about campaign donations. But also, clearly, the personal relations at the top of the Welsh government are not nearly good enough. This kind of thing doesn't happen unless there's more to it than that.
Well, and of course,
this is a personal beef.
Yeah, and he lost that vote of confidence because two of his MPs were apparently ill. Now, that wasn't terribly convincing at the time, but can he sustain this?
No, I think this is the end of Vaughan Gething's, and I think there's going to have to be a remodelling of the Welsh government. I don't quite know what follows. I don't know if they end up with an election or how that would work even.
Andrew, we are incredibly excellent at soothsaying, because it has just come in now. Our producers just told us that Vaughan Gething has indeed resigned.
Gone.
There we have it. Another, presumably, leadership election in some form to go on in Wales.
Another leadership election, another sort of political drama for us all to get our heads around. The question that's in my mind is, how much damage does this do to Keir Starmer and the new Labour government in Westminster? Because these are people that Keir Starmer has backed. Mm-hmm. She's backed all of them, the ones who've resigned and the ones who haven't, I suppose. And the Welsh Labour government, it's been nothing like as scandal hit as the Scottish SNP government. But it's had problems of its own, going back to the pandemic, going back to bans on fast driving around Welsh roads. It's been unpopular in all sorts of ways. Lots of controversy over its handling of the health service in Wales, for instance.
I mean, do you think it will damage Keir Starmer in any way, or is it remote enough that it won't?
I think this is just a little reminder of political mortality, that in the end, it's all about human beings, and humans are frail and make mistakes. And no matter how big your majority is, stuff will happen. Resignations will happen. Mm-hmm. Scandals will happen. And they'll happen at Westminster as well as in Wales.
Well, back to Westminster. Tomorrow we have the state opening of Parliament, the new government, including its host of fresh-faced baby MPs, and the Lords and assorted dignitaries will gather to hear the King's speech. We're expecting a fair amount of bills in this one.
I think people are talking about 30 or so different measures, which is much more than the previous Conservative King's speeches have been, or Queen's speeches have been. This is a huge moment for the new government, because it allows us all to see the direction of travel for the next 12 to 18 months or whatever, and what their priorities are and what their priorities are not. So, for instance, what are they actually going to say about Lords reform? How far are they going to go at a time when they're trying to stuff the Lords with lots of new Labour peers to get their own business through? That's very interesting. What are they going to do about the two-child cap, possibly the next big source of rebellion? Are they really interested in the Constitution? I'm told that everything in this is about growth. Therefore, how far are they actually going to go in tearing up the old planning controls? Is it going to be as radical as the rhetoric on the election campaign or not? So it's a very, very important moment, not just for Starmer, but for the entire government.
I'm sure we'll go through the details of what is in and what's out tomorrow. But what do you expect we might learn from any package about the government, about what they fundamentally believe?
That is a really good question. I've been trying to write about this. Going back to the old Tony Blair phrase about what is my irreducible core, he once asked, by which we mean the fundamental value system and the fundamental beliefs. And I think this is a really interesting and surprisingly difficult question to answer about Keir Starmer's government. I was first struck by this when I realised that this is the most secular parliament we have ever elected. Some 40% of MPs have chosen not to affirm an oath to God, but to take a secular declaration instead. That's by far bigger than it's ever been before.
It was about a quarter, wasn't it?
About a quarter last time, and it's now jumped a lot. And it apparently includes half the cabinet. But when you think more deeply about the cabinet, actually, although Keir Starmer is not a believer, Rachel Reeves comes from a Salvation Army family. Wes Streeting is very open about his Christian faith and has discussed it in terms of his own sexuality. Jonathan Reynolds is an ardent Christian and said that was part of the motivating factor from resigning from Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet. David Lammy, again, a profound Christian. So some of the biggest voices in the government are, in fact, motivated by religion. But you can't really say that this is a government in the tradition of Christian socialism. Because if you look at that tradition, too many of them are not Christians, and too many of them don't talk about ethical values in the same way that, you know, Callaghan or Wilson or John Smith or indeed Tony Blair would have done. So I think we are into a new territory. And talking to lots of people and trying to mind my way through this, it seems to me that there are various principles. First of all, there is a sort of scientism about this government. They believe very strongly in evidence and hard facts. And if you look at the motivation, for instance, behind the new Green Deal, that's going to be a very, very big part of the story of the next few years. That is not driven, as the Tory right-wing press suggests, by some kind of slightly woolly ideology. It's driven by hard science, hard climate science. That's what's driving it, and that's what they're committed to.
And we've seen the appointment of Patrick Vallance, the former chief scientific advisor.
Exactly, in that tradition. And even beefing up the OBR, for instance, suggests that this is a government which, in strong contradistinction to Mr. Michael Gove, has not had enough of experts. So there's a kind of hard science expertise motivation behind it. I think there's also what I would call a kind of liberal legal instrumentalism, by which I mean simply a real conviction, and this comes from Starmer, that you can use the law and you can use the law ever more imaginatively and perhaps aggressively in order to smooth out wrinkles and problems and inequities in society, to reshape society. And that's part of the underlying thinking that I am slightly concerned about, because that's fine if you're using the law which goes completely with the grain of society. But when you're talking about the struggle between women's rights and trans rights, where there is no agreed grain of direction at all, or if you're talking, for instance, about proposals by some people to introduce a specific ban on Islamophobia in all its forms, which would begin to feel like a blasphemy law coming in through the back door. If Islam is going to have a special law to protect it, what about Christianity? What about Hinduism? And so on. There are areas there which I think for lots of people could feel mildly or less than mildly oppressive.
But any attempt at a blasphemy law is, I mean, it's not gone down well in Scotland.
It's
they
gone
would
down.
Be ill-advised to do that, surely.
I think they would be very ill-advised. I'm just trying to pick out the sort of basal instincts. And I think that sort of legal instrumentalism is certainly one of them. But I think there's a much more kind of generous set of ideas as well at the core of this government. I was talking to one of Keir Starmer's closest advisers who said, well, you know, we're all really influenced by what happened to Britain in the wake, really, of the financial crash and the number of people who these days feel like they're strangers in their own country. They're not even recognised in their own country. And for Keir, this is absolutely central, is the idea of giving them respect. Whereas the new Labour governments thought about those kinds of people in terms of better targeted welfare payments and welfare benefits and regulation of the private sector. Starmer thinks about employment, ambition, life chances, and above all, respect. The same advisor said to me of Keir Starmer, he said, respect is his equivalent of equality. And I think that's a really pithy, really important signal about what this government is all about. I think that tension between respect and equality is at the center of the political argument we're going to have for years ahead. In the end, it's only the big moral choices that Keir Starmer and his team make, whether it's on the two-child benefit cap or the tension between saving bits of Green England and building more houses, and how they explain those choices. That is how we will eventually come to understand what this government is really about.
Can I ask you about religion? Because, as you say, it's the most irreligious parliament we've had, and yet you have some of these big Labour beasts who are very open about their faith. We see this in the States as well. There seems to be, in this country at least, of course, religion isn't seen so overtly in politics, but do you think generally the public have a sort of a disrespect for people with faith?
I mean, how can I speak for the British public, Hannah? But, you know, my impression is that people actually quite like leaders of different kinds who have some kind of belief system, some kind of faith often a religious faith, and can explain it in clear, human, understandable terms. But they don't necessarily want to go to church themselves. In other words, it's all right for you people, but not for me. This has become one of the most secular societies in the world. But if you know, you look at the England football team, even if they didn't go all the way, very, very driven. It's, you know, a fundamentally Christian team. And of course, when I say Christian, I'm really talking about the black Pentecostalist churches to which so many of the younger black players belong. Mm-hmm. So religion is beginning to reinsert itself through that and, of course, through Islam into the national conversation in a way that it hasn't been for a while. But I'm just really struck because all the way through the story of the Labour Party in the 20th century, the church, the chapel were absolutely fundamental to the way people spoke and explained themselves. And you go right the way back to people like Tawney. You go even back to sort of cynics like Crossland, Tony Crossland, who came from a very strict sect called the Close Brethren, like the Plymouth Brethren. And you go through to the way that Harold Wilson's famous comment about there was more of Methodism than Marx in his politics, and through to Callaghan, and John Smith buried on Iona. It's been a very powerful trait. And I think it's as simple as you don't walk past on the other side. And I think it's as simple as, you know, it's harder for a camel to go through the eye of needle than for rich sods to avoid their taxes, or whatever the biblical phrase was. It's that kind of basic moral stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're not imposing your faith on other people, but it gives you a moral backbone.
You're not saying you have to have a belief in the Trinity or anything else. You're just saying these are our kind of basic human values. And of course, the golden rule, do unto others. You know, you find that in Confucian thought. You find it in different forms in Hinduism. You find it all around the world.
Thank you very much for listening. If you've been enjoying our political coverage and would like to be notified of all future episodes, please hit follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss on a future episode, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. If you're listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the episode page and type your reply. Or if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Hannah Barnes, and my colleague, Andrew Marr. I'll be back tomorrow with details of the King's Speech. This episode was produced by Chris Stone. The video editors are Grace Braddock and Rob Lemaire.
It can be hard balancing taking care of kids, senior loved ones, and yourself. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Find background-checked sitters, nannies, and senior caregivers who can help with everything from watching kids after school to senior meal prep. Whether you need full-time, part-time, or even occasional help, you can view rates and book highly rated caregivers that fit your budget and schedule. Get the help you need with Care.com.
Hi, this is Farnoosh Tarabi, host of the Webby-winning podcast, So Money. If you're aiming for a goal, be it saving for a house, growing your family, or retiring, life makes it difficult to stay the course. But with a dedicated Merrill advisor, you get a personalized plan and a clear path forward. Having the bull at your back helps your whole financial life move with you. So when your plans change, Merrill's with you every step of the way. Go to ml.com/bullish to learn more. Merrill, a Bank of America company. What would you like the power to do? Investing involves risk. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, registered broker-dealer, registered investment advisor, member SIPC.